The current political debates have gone far beyond discussions of the economy, unemployment, and foreign policy to include calls to defund Planned Parenthood, to reinstate Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and to question whether same-sex marriage, contraception, and even prenatal care should be allowed. In her new book, Delirium, How the Sexual Counter-Revolution is Polarizing America, Nancy L. Cohn traces this aspect of the current political debate to the rise of well-organized opposition to the changes in sexual policy over the past 40 years, which she argues has irreconcilably polarized the nation. Her book is published by Counterpoint Press, and I'm very pleased to welcome Nancy Cohn to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Wonderful to be here with you.
So as I said, there are many important issues facing our country today, the lagging economy, jobs, national security. Why have so many politicians been stressing sex as a political motivator?
Well, if we knew the history of the sexual counter-revolution, we wouldn't be surprised. Now, it's not smart for Republicans to be focusing on birth control now. I mean, it is 2012, but it's a logical result of 40 years of this movement. So in my book, Delirium, I tell the story of how a small group of reactionaries who want to control sex have hijacked American politics.
But you say it may not be the best political approach. Rick Santorum's condemnation of abortion, birth control, same-sex marriage, homosexuality in general, and his latest suggestion that prenatal care in public schools contribute to a culture of abortion seem to have energized his campaign.
Exactly. It's energized the base. So 40 to 50 to 60% of the Republican electorate is very conservative on these issues of sex and gay rights and feminism. And so Santorum is playing to the base. But in a general election, it's not a smart idea because these people are a minority of the national electorate.
So is it feminism that started this whole thing, or is it opposition to abortion that has led to
what you call the sexual
counter-revolution?
I'm a historian, and I started working on this book by asking the question, how did we get here? And I was actually quite surprised to see that this movement started with opposition to the Equal Rights Amendment that would have written equal rights for women into the Constitution.
And people like Phyllis Schlafly.
People like Phyllis Schlafly, who was the leader. But what happened is it mobilized Protestant fundamentalist women and Mormon women and Orthodox Catholics, in many cases who hadn't been voting before. And they got politically active on the grassroots level to campaign to stop the Equal Rights Amendment, to stop the federal government from funding child care, to roll back civil rights for gays. And all of these campaigns occurred before they started moving against abortion.
But this new mood suggests an alliance between the Catholic Church and fundamentalist leaders. Was that something that actually was affected, or did they just find themselves on the same side of certain issues?
They found themselves on the same side of these issues in the mid-70s, when on one side the fundamentalists started organizing. Schlafly herself is an Orthodox Catholic and played a big role in training these people who had no political experience to how to lobby, how to do communications, and how to mobilize on the grassroots level in the Republican Party.
Well, not everybody who's opposed to abortion is religious, but a great majority seem to be, and often protests involve carrying religious symbols and making religious points, and that applies to same-sex marriage and a lot of other things. So is this really an outburst of religious feeling in this country?
That's a good question. It's hard to tell whether it's the religion or the sex, honestly. And what you do see is that this outburst of religious feeling did not come about until the sexual revolution and feminism and gay rights changed everything. So, yes, it is deeply rooted in a very traditional religion, across religions that often don't disagree with each other. Mormons are working with fundamentalists in this case.
Well, fundamentalists have never, as far as I know, been opposed to contraception. But now contraception is once again a political hot potato. We even have someone like Foster Freeze quipping that women should just put an aspirin between their knees as a form of contraception. And we have Congress calling hearings on President Obama's contraception coverage rules.
Yes. Well, if you look at what they were saying in the summer when the rule was first announced. It was a lot about sex. Now, Cardinal Dolan said the other day that latex and chemicals are part of the culture of death. So there's this connection made between birth control allowing sexual freedom, particularly for women, and the destruction of the family and the loss of America as a Christian nation, that is the sentiment, the passion behind this anti-birth control.
So it's also just the changes in the way the nuclear family is structured that are a big issue here. We're talking about a lot of different things,
yes,
aren't we?
Yes, yes. And what I do is trace the way each of these different issues kind of plays out in our politics and show how, you know, kind of concerns about the destruction of the nuclear family, that's only a small minority of the country are really that worried about it, have driven people to organize within the Republican Party and push it farther and farther to the right.
There was a call at one point, we don't hear it as much anymore, although maybe it's coming back, for stay-at-home moms. People said that women going to work pretty much destroying the fabric of the nation.
Yes, well,
this seems to be a Rick Santorum.
Yes, it is a Rick Santorum
campaign issue as well.
Yes. Rick Santorum, who says his wife wrote that section of his book, his stay-at-home wife, which was fascinating. And he's attacking the idea that women should serve in combat on the front lines, even though they are serving in combat on the front lines. So I think we saw a bit of a shift in the Republican Party with the rise of Sarah Palin and Michelle Bachmann. There are a lot of very conservative women who embrace the traditional family, but still want to say that women should have equal power.
Wasn't the GOP pro-choice at one time?
Absolutely. It was these women activists who changed the GOP from being, frankly, much better on women's rights and personal freedom, from which their pro-choice position went. In the 1980 election, these women who had experience on the grassroots level in the states went into the Republican convention and they rewrote the platform to take support for the Equal Rights Amendment out of it and to take support for federally funded child care out of it. And honestly, the most powerful woman in the Republican Party was thrown out of her position in the party because of this mobilization on the Republican right.
That was the election where Ronald Reagan was elected president. Were the Reagan people in support of that?
The Reagan people had seen this rising in the states, and they allied with the religious right and the women's movement. And so Reagan he basically cut a deal with them on this.
My guest is Nancy L. Cohn. She's written a book called Delirium, How the Sexual Counterrevolution is Polarizing America, and it is published by Counterpoint. You point to 1972 as the birth of the sexual counterrevolution. That's the year of the Supreme Court decision?
No, the Supreme Court decision was January 1973. This actually started
a year before.
Yes. It started earlier around the Equal Rights Amendment in the Republican Party. But in the Democratic Party, there was a reaction among some of the older power brokers to women and feminists and gays and black activists getting more power in the party. And the head of labor said that year, the Democratic Party has been taken over by abortionists and boys who want to marry boys and jacks who look like Johns and smell like Jacks who look like Jills and smell like Johns. And it was almost the only time in the 20th century that labor did not support the Democratic Party.
Well, there are still Democrats who are opposed to abortion, who are opposed to same-sex marriage. So this is not – and there are Republicans who have voted to allow same-sex marriage in our state, for example. So why has it come down to looking like a Republican issue and not an issue of the Democrats?
A couple reasons. One, Democrats have never really lost votes for being pro-choice. They've actually won elections. It was a huge advantage to Clinton in 92, an advantage to Obama in 2008. The Democratic Party took on more progressive positions, and they've actually won millions of voters over to the party for being socially progressive. Professionals left the Republican Party by 92. Mainline Protestants left. A lot of working women who are pretty centrist on economic issues vote Democratic because it's a more progressive party.
But as Tom Frank pointed out in Whatever Happened to Kansas, many people who were traditionally Democrats who voted for the Democratic Party because of economic issues have switched to the Republican Party because of social issues of the sort that you're talking about here.
Yes, that's
so what happened? Was it a matter of people suddenly panicking?
Frank is actually wrong about that. All the statistics, all the studies by political scientists show that working class voters still tend to favor Democrats. The real shift happened.
You haven't gone to a Tea Party rally then.
But where they shifted was not on the social issues. There's a lot of details in the book about which groups are voting which way. But the studies show that, if anything, Democrats have picked up these white male voters on the social issues, and these people have actually turned against the Democrats on their liberal economics. So there have been many articles written about this in the academic literature.
You devote quite a few pages to the Clinton-Monica Lewinsky scandal, saying that rank-and-file sexual fundamentalists were the most avid consumers of the titillating fare about the Clinton escapades. Now, Clinton, even before he was elected president, was branded as a kind of child of the permissive 60s. So wasn't that to be expected? Didn't he just simply fulfill certain people's prophecies?
I guess you could say that, but the people that were making those prophecies were a very small minority of people. So if you look at public opinion polls throughout Clinton's presidency, and every time one of these sex scandals came up, a good two-thirds of the country is saying, yeah, we don't really think much of it, but this isn't a political issue. This is a private matter, and we don't want our politics hijacked by these distractions.
What's the role of the TV people, Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, in all of this, and someone like Ralph Reed, who was the first executive director of the Christian Coalition?
Mm-hmm. They play different roles. Falwell, I think, gets too much credit for organizing the religious right. I think he was taking advantage of this prior mobilization of women. Robertson and Reed are key figures because of their creation of the Christian Coalition, which took advantage of these existing grassroots networks of these sexual fundamentalists agitated over issues of sex and women and gays, and gave it real political heft. So they expanded it, and they really helped make it effective as an electoral force. And I would say that Ralph Reed is actually back with the Faith and Freedom Coalition that was behind the recall of the Iowa judges over gay marriage. They were early backers of Newt Gingrich's campaign. We see them mentioned in a lot of the stories about Santorum.
And he's been connected to a number of scandals, and yet he seems to come back again and again, seemingly unscathed.
Redemption.
You quote him as saying the most important strategy for evangelicals is secrecy.
Yes. This gets to one of the important ways that Republicans have won elections. Basically, Americans as a whole don't really like religion infusing politics. And so the Republican Party has reached a point where it can't win elections without these religious right voters, but it also can't win when they're too closely identified with them. So Reed and many others know that stealth at a particular moment when they're unpopular is a successful electoral strategy, and that is in many ways how the Tea Party, which was a little more than a rebranding of the Christian right, came into power in 2010 on the so-called small government, freedom-loving agenda. And one of the first things they do when they come into office is practically shut down the government over funding for birth control.
even though they claim that they're not really interested in those social issues. They're mostly interested in economic issues.
Yes, well, they say that, and it gets repeated in the media, but that doesn't mean that's what's motivating the base.
No, many people said that John McCain made a big mistake when he invited Sarah Palin to be his vice presidential candidate, his running mate. Do you think that was he just appealing to this part of the Republican base?
Yes, a number of reporters have told the story of how McCain wanted to nominate Joe Lieberman as his vice president, and the sexual fundamentalist said, no way, we're going to bolt if you do that. So he knew he had to nominate a religious conservative. And they foolishly, I think, went for Palin on the idea that they could put her over as an interesting woman in the post-Hillary moment. So they were trying to do a stealth campaign as well and hoping that Palin would stay on message as a maverick. Well, she didn't.
Well, we had a number of other religious candidates, Rick Perry, Michelle Bachmann, and to some degree it was felt that they hurt themselves partly because they came across as being a little too religious. Now we have Rick Santorum challenging Mitt Romney. There's a good chance he will win in Michigan, maybe mm-hmm. a few other states. So
how do you explain it? Yeah.
Yeah, how do we explain that?
So the sexual fundamentalists are basically the gatekeepers of the Republican Party. And when they're coming off of a big win like 2010, they tend to overreach. They want a purist in as their candidate. So that was the momentum behind Perry and Bachmann, et cetera. They were just terrible candidates as president. Right? Now Santorum, who is a senator, smart man, can handle himself on the stump much better and at debates. Now he's starting to say extremely crazy things from the perspective of most Americans, you know, no prenatal testing, no public schools. And so I think there's still a hope that they can get a pure conservative there.
Well, if they are the gatekeepers, what do they ask for in exchange for entrance?
They ask for orthodoxy on abortion and gay rights and birth control. So let's take a look at Romney. Now, Romney has promised everything to these people. He's essentially come out in favor of the personhood constitutional amendments. He's promised he'll back a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage. That constitutional amendment, as written, would also ban civil unions. So they are really demanding that any candidate go whole in on their social agenda. And I really don't see how any candidate is going to be able to thumb his nose at them when he gets in.
Well, in the past, there usually were variations within in these kinds of discussions. But what we're seeing, at least, the Democrats already have their candidate. But what we're seeing with the Republican candidates is everybody pretty much agreeing, even if in the past they had different positions. So where does that leave the Republican Party right now?
I think that leaves the Republican Party electorally in a very bad place because they've put themselves really out on the fringe of American opinion. Now, America needs a strong two-party system, and it would, from my perspective, and I think a lot of other people's perspective, be a really good thing for the fiscal conservatives and the moderates who think these positions are crazy to reassert themselves and really organize in as powerfully as the others in the party.
Now, why do you think that didn't work in the 2010 election?
Well, the 2010 election was a time when they really drove a lot of the moderates out of office. And
you say
that the
electorate was older, whiter, and more religious than the American population as a whole. Why weren't younger people voting in that election?
They were demoralized. So one of the things that the Democrats did was not really speak to their base because they got scared by the Tea Party. They believed that people really cared about these fiscal issues, that it was really all about the budget. And so 40 million people who voted in 2008 did not vote in 2010, disproportionately younger and, you know, single women. Basically, the Democrats' base didn't show up. And the Republican base is, in fact, this older, whiter, very religious, very conservative group of people. They've really lost a lot of the other voting publics in the American population.
The California, which is considered a generally liberal state, voted for Proposition 8, which eliminated same-sex marriage. So this is an issue that goes way beyond these counter-revolutionaries. Why do you think there's so much, although the pendulum seems to be swinging to some degree toward more states allowing it? There's New Hampshire, I think there's a movement to change their same-sex marriage law. And I'm not sure that if California voted on Proposition 8 that the result would be all that different.
Well, I live in California, and I would say the result probably would be different. And there are a few things that happened there. One, they had a really bad campaign for Proposition 8. I mean, they had an endorsement from from Barack Obama against Prop 8, but they didn't bother to run that in the African-American community. Now, opinion has really shifted very rapidly even since 2008, and the vast majority of the polls show a majority in favor of gay marriage. But we're not required to vote in every election, so people who organize well can tip the election.
Well, you talk about a counter-revolution here. Do you think we are also seeing a counter-revolution as we saw in the response to the controversy surrounding the Susan G. Komen Foundation's revocation of donations to Planned Parenthood's breast cancer programs?
Yes, absolutely. I think when people realize that these are the motives and the passions of the Republican Party and what they might do in office, people become mobilized, and they realize that they have to stay involved in the election.
But do you think that the system is, as you say, irreconcilably polarized?
I don't think the system is irreconcilably polarized. I do think that if we had turnout at very high levels in all elections, the sexual counter-revolution would become such a minority that the Republican Party would have to reform itself.
Nancy L. Cohen's book, Delirium, How the Sexual Counterrevolution is Polarizing America, is published by Counterpoint Press. And I want to thank you for being on our show today.
Thank you very much.